Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am Jack Pelling, and with me, as ever, is...
It's Robin Allender here.
Hi, man. How are you?
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Slightly perturbed by the prospect of pubs closing at 10 o'clock for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's 360 hours of pub time, potential pub time that we're going
to
lose.
I feel like it's just a deliberate attempt to kind of decrease morale at this point, isn't it? Like, you know, why are they doing
it? Well, it feels like a bit of a personal attack, because they are always my favourite hours, the slightly hazy period between 10 and 11.
Yeah, and also, isn't it just going to encourage people, oh, just come back to mine and have a few cans?
Yeah, and let's go to the pub at 5 instead of 6.
Yeah, oh dear.
But, you know, hey-ho.
Remember when pubs used to close at 10 on Sundays? I suppose some still do.
Yeah.
That was a hang-up from the Blitz, wasn't it? They just forgot to put it back afterwards.
It doesn't surprise me, because
I'm worried that that's going to happen.
Rule.
You know, if things go back to normal, they'll just forget to put it back.
I did quite like it when I worked in the bar, though, because on Sunday nights you only had the real dedicated booze hounds.
Yeah.
So the 10 o'clock bell was always quite welcome. But, yeah, this week we've got another fantastic episode with Jono, a writer, a comedian, and a third of the comedy trio Sheeps. This was a really, really fun one.
Yeah, it was great. And it was the first one we'd done kind of all in a room together. It was, you know, a few cans were drunk and... Yeah, it was good. It was pretty discursive. I was worried that I'd listen back to it and think we sounded tipsy, but I don't think we did sound too tipsy.
No, I think we managed to sort of hit the sweet spot a little bit. And there's a little bit of talking over each other towards the end, but I think let's call it...
No, you listen to me! There's none of that.
No, it's more sort of exuberance than inebriation.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, there's loads of great chat. We start off talking about Shakespeare for some reason,
yeah,
so do bear with us. But we move
about.
Swiftly on to the Beatles. We talk about Jono's love of the mid-period specifically. Mm. And then we move on to all sorts of things, including sort of metal and Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah, sitcoms. Yeah, that was. I suppose Beatles and comedy is obviously going to be a recurring thing. On this podcast, but yeah, there was some chat about Only Fools and Horses. There's a good anecdote about Del Boy falling through the bar. That was quite funny.
So before we crack on with that, you've got a little bit of correspondence to...
Yeah, the first thing I was going to do is just give a little plug. When we started the podcast, one of the first people to follow us on the social medias was a chap called Joe, who runs a social media account called Beatles Books on Instagram, which is a really amazing account because his extraordinary scope of Beatles books he's got there is pretty unprecedented. And he's also just started...
Yeah, it's pretty baffling.
It is great, isn't it? It's like, I'm sure he's invented some. But he's just started a podcast under the same name, Beatles Books. So, yeah, give that a plug. I'm sure that's
going nice. To be I'll
a
check
brilliant
that out.
Podcast. Yeah, it's great. But speaking of Beatles books, my friend Ed Dowie, and Ed is a brilliant musician. He's got an amazing album out. Well, it came out a few years ago called The Uncle Sold on Lost Map. But I'd love to have him on, actually. But he said he's got two books about the Beatles, and one of them was called The Murder of John Lennon. And the other one is a book he found on the street called Paul McCartney, Behind the Myth. Have you ever heard of this book?
I have not, no.
It's written by a Daily Express columnist, and he can't hide his roots. Just read this bit. So it was about Paul. Had he bothered to acquire the intellectual self-discipline necessary to complete his A-level successfully, the trite flaccidity of many of his later song lyrics might have been avoided, and disasters like Magical Mystery Tour and Give My Regards to Broad Street might have been avoided... It's quite. It's very.
Who wrote this?
So this is a guy called Ross Benson, and this is his author's bio. It's very Partridge. Ross Benson is a close friend of many of the Beatles' intimates and advisors. Knows Ringo Starr, and lists Bianca Jagger among his friends. He got to know Paul McCartney in 1980 when McCartney was in prison in Japan. He was the only British journalist allowed into the jail when McCartney was being held, and his exclusive reports made front page news.
Well,
so yeah,
there you
that's
go.
Great. This is a. Can I read you a couple more extracts, Edison?
Please,
they are quite
funny. I really, really want to hear them.
On 14th of August 1960, the Beatles, yet to become the most profitable small specified business Liverpool ever produced, such a weird way to describe them, it's very, very Partridge, was on its way to being discovered in Germany. Like Liverpool, Hamburg is a port with a long and prosperous past. They are both situated at the latitude 53 degrees north. There the comparison ends. That's really oddly specific. That's great. He keeps going on about how they were a profitable small business.
I know, it's such a weird take.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to everyone else who got in touch. And as always, you can keep in touch with us on social media at Personal Beatles on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And if you want to email the show, you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. You can also support the show by going to personalbeatles.com/donate. A few more people have done it this week, and we're really, really grateful. It helps us keep going and plan, you know, bigger and better things. So really exciting and helpful, as is rating the show on Apple Podcasts and Acast. And we're now available on Amazon Music. I don't think I've ever met anyone who listens to Amazon Music, but if you are a new listener... Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Hello, one person.
I was going to say as well, can I mention our weird discovery about Spotify, which is that we kind of occasionally make an edit when we've made a particularly bad mistake in a podcast. But we noticed that the edits don't seem to go through to Spotify. So you're listening. If you're listening on Spotify, then you are hearing the unexpurgated drivel. More rubbish than normal. Sorry,
it's like a director's cut, but a bad director's
cut. Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Alien 3.
It's more like a bloopers reel.
Yeah, exactly. Right, let's crack on with Jono, and we'll be back at the end of the show. Please enjoy Jono from Sheeps.
Shakespeare as well, isn't it? Shakespeare, if you go to a Shakespeare play, sometimes you laugh and you've got absolutely no idea why, don't you?
Because no.
You never.
No,
never
I do not. Interestingly, I find I don't.
But it's the kind of thing an English teacher, when an English teacher would go there and say
chuckle,
that, chuckle, because
yeah.
they get the joke.
Sure.
But sometimes, like,
I
you
think
go,
they're pretending.
But that's that performative. That's the laugh that I think I like the least in the world is the laugh where you go, well, you want everyone else to know.
Yeah.
Any voluntary laugh, I think, is no good.
Yeah,
you just
don't,
it's horrible to hear.
Yeah, it's like,
well, you could have not done it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think if you do go and see a good Shakespeare-like production, even if you don't understand it, there are certain intonations which are funny or like timings, I think.
Sure.
Do you think so?
Yeah, but I think people at work, a lot of times people are getting, this is not me, this is not my, you know, my... taking a stance against Shakespeare.
You know? Because
I know he could easily snap back about some of my stuff.
Yeah.
I know I'm leaving myself wide open, and this guy's known for being good with words.
Well, you don't
much
to the
in the same way as his
podcast.
Nemesis me. But when are you getting Shakespeare in here?
Oh, yeah. Shakespeare waiting, calmly ages. Dismantles.
But I do think, like, a lot of comedy productions of Shakespeare, the performances are like almost pantomime big in order to be like, well, I feel like you maybe don't have confidence in the material here,
or
you don't. It's not that it's not funny, but it's just like I think you maybe aren't comfortable enough leaving the joke there for the audience to pick up.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of thrusting at any kind of sexual innuendo.
Yeah, yeah, and also the thing I find funniest is where people like act out. When people resort to acting out each word individually within a sentence, like to the point of, you just, well, I like going to the theatre, but I'm if I were being honest, I would say 9 times out of 10. I mean, this is the worst thing to possibly be saying at this moment in time when the arts are in such danger from a government that doesn't care and clearly should. And but for me, 9 times out of 10, and this is also true of comedy shows, and I suspect would be true if I watched any of my own comedy shows. 9 times out of 10, I feel like I would leave at the interval and read the what happens the rest of it. Like, oh, I get how they do it, and then now I'll just find out what happens on the bus.
Do you know that Sarah Pascoe does a really brilliant bit about going to the theatre? You don't actually enjoy it at the end. That feeling you have is just the relief that it's over. You know, it's just so good.
There's that great episode of Peep Show where they go and sort of watch a play above a pub and they start whispering to each other, being like, we could be at home watching Heat. Like we're watching Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, but we're here.
That's great.
But one thing that I find weird, so to bring it onto the Beatles in a slightly neat
that band,
segue,
yes.
I always find it weird watching old Beatles live shows that everyone is sitting down.
Mm.
And I now am at the age where I sit down at a gig.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like sitting down.
Is that your preference?
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. Also because it just gets rid of my main worry in life. And this is not just... This is in absolutely every element of life. I just don't know what to do with my hands any of the time. And it's like, it's hell being in a crowd stood around people. You just... My instinct is to just have my arms behind my back. I'm acting it out, which is famously fantastic for this medium. But I'd like tie my hands around each other behind my back and just... bob and hope that I don't get knocked over.
Mm. My idea would be there's a bit at the front where people can stand, and I'm sort of seated above them watching. in my ivory tower. Because sometimes the band will play better if there are people right at the front moshing. Or jumping around.
Yeah, that's definitely
but
true.
I don't want to be there. I want to be.
And they'd play. You don't think the band would be distracted by the hovering gentleman on the chair? That would, to me, I wouldn't be able to keep time.
Well, you know, I'm invisible as well. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I considered forking out when Paul McCartney last did the O2 for the little standing bit at the front.
Oh, yeah.
But then I just couldn't justify it. But, you know, I mean, it probably is the last time, especially with, like, the current environment, might be the last time you see him. But that was the first time that I broke my O2 embargo, was to go and see him a couple of years ago.
Right.
And we were, you know, for what you're paying... you are a long way away. Mm. And it was testament to Paul that he can like make you come away from watching that show in a seat like that and thinking you've had the best night ever.
Essentially, you know, leveraging the threat that he might die over you. At some point of like, do you want to not see me?
Yeah. Well, I'd much rather pay that to see him in a big field than at the O2. Have you ever seen Paul?
I've not, no. And that is... that's something I'm afraid of all the time. It's a similar situation to I had a friend of mine had tickets for Prince, probably the last time he was in the UK, and I didn't get tickets, he did, and he got ill on the day and he offered me the tickets and I was so excited, and then about 2 hours before the show he got in contact with me and said, I'm feeling a lot better, I'm going to go.
Oh.
And I think about it all the time. If there's some way I could have got him out of commission for a bit longer.
I went to Glastonbury 2009 and Neil Young was playing.
Yeah.
And I went to see Animal Collective.
Why'd you do that then?
I don't know. At the time, this isn't to diss Animal Collective, but yeah, I don't know. I might never get the chance to see Neil Young again.
No.
And that was. I don't know what was
That's
going through
error.
My head.
Yeah.
A guy I was on a stag do once went to go and see Prince at Ronnie Scott's, and he queued up for, you know, 24 hours or something and saw this absolutely explosive show, and then he went and hid in the toilet because he was doing 2 shows. So he had to sit in the toilet at Ronnie Scott's for like 3 hours.
Really?
And then came out and watched it all again.
Fantastic.
The Beatles fans used to do that, didn't they? They used to hide in the toilets.
Yeah, because they used to do two lots of shows. Like their touring schedule... in those first 2 UK tours is absolutely insane.
The shows are crazy short, seemingly.
Well, the shows towards the end were really short when they had already kind of given up. So, like, especially on that massive 1966 tour where they play the same set list for, 9 months, but it's only sort of 12 2-minute songs that were then 4 years old or whatever.
Yeah, the songs were just so short as well. Well, it's not, I mean, under three, all of them under 3 minutes, really, aren't they?
And it was, I don't know what the rationale behind the set list was, but because, you know, they'd made sort of Rubber Soul and Revolver, and obviously there are tracks that you can't do live. But why are you still playing, you know...
You could do And Your Bird
Babies
Can
in
Sing
Black every night.
You could do, you know, you could do I'm Looking Through You. There's so many just, like, straight-up rockers on those two albums that would be a delight to have heard. They clearly just didn't want to learn them.
But, I don't know. And Your Bird Can Sing is hard, though, isn't it? That would
be
hard.
Well, you need two guitarists playing quite intricately. What's do you have a favourite era of Beatles, then?
Right smack bang in the middle, Rubber Soul would be literally it. As a kid, well, when I eventually allowed myself to be into the Beatles, because initially I decided I didn't like them.
Right.
Purely because I felt I wasn't allowed to, because it was
what,
my
the
dad's
credibility
music.
Right,
it was just it was my dad's music, and so I had to not like it. Right. And so, but I'd secretly be like, I really like this.
Mm.
But then eventually... I think the thing that made me feel like I was allowed to listen to the Beatles was when Sum 41 covered I'm a Loser. I instantly was like, well, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. We talk about that. This has come up quite a lot with people when they're quite young and impressionable. There's this sort of weird negotiation they make with, am I cool?
Yeah. I think probably because my dad didn't really like the Beatles that it made me like them more, probably.
Yeah.
If it had been evangelical about it, I would have been like, oh, shut up, Dad.
Well, he was really into them, and as a result, I just want to... I wanted to be different. So eventually, the compromise I came to with myself was, Dad likes the early Beatles, so I actually... I don't like them. I don't like the early Beatles.
Yeah.
But I love the late Beatles. Yeah. Well, enjoy your teeny bopping, Dad. I'm listening to the big music, the serious music.
But and, you were introduced to them by Sum 41.
Kind of. Well, yeah, sort of. Well, I was reintroduced to them as You're Allowed to Like Them by Sum 41.
Yeah,
even though the track they are playing is from Beatles for Sale, it's, I still... But the nice compromise was, as I've got older, I like the early Beatles more than the late Beatles now. But the nice compromise was that both my dad and I... agree that Rubber Soul's their best album.
Mm.
So you cross over in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's true. That's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, when you're growing up and you're into more sort of punky, pushing the boundary sounds, then you want to
kind of get...
Sum 41. Yeah. Grunge pioneers.
That hard stuff.
Yeah. You kind of are drawn to, like, your Abbey Road and White Album. But then there's something to be said for, like, going back to that and appreciating the craft of those really, really early songs.
Yeah. And I think if you've had a period in your life where you love those early records, then you appreciate the later ones more.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Definitely the way that, you know, if you listen to something like Oh Darling, which is... Band in the Room stuff, you know, that you get that sort of really nice warm sense of familiarity of them, especially when you know that they're not getting on.
Yeah,
it always worked when it was the four of them in the room, and that's like
and one after 909 as well.
Well, I mean, that was the kind of concept
they wrote, did it a lot later.
Yeah, they did it. It's on Let It Be, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's one of those where they sort of, you know, they're putting out so many songs they forget. For the better part of a decade, and one of the other ones just says, like Michelle from Rubber Soul, where it was like a joke song that McCartney would play at a party when his party piece was pretending to be French.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know what, but he didn't know. But he was like, I read an interview when he was like, but the only word I knew in French was Michelle, and I was like, well, that's not a French that's not a French word. So I don't know what he was playing at.
So do you not enjoy the sort of progression? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing you love Revolver as well. But
no,
what,
I like
what
the whole
is
thing.
It about Rubber Soul that tips over the edge for Revolver? Because I always think of them as being two sides of the tipping point.
Yeah, I think it's 14 songs and I don't think any of them are bad.
Mm.
And there are bits of Revolver I find myself skipping through. I actually don't like the opening track on either of those albums.
Taxman.
I don't like Taxman, I don't like Drive My Car.
Really?
It just seems too, like, I don't know, it feels lame, but probably in the way that anything that's super influential and loads of people have taken off when you listen back just doesn't sound original. I feel like, well, I don't want this from the Beatles.
Mm. Yeah. I listened back to Rubber Soul all the way through for the first time intently the other day, and it did make me think, actually, I don't listen to this enough. Yeah, but one thing that I texted you about it was that I find they'd obviously got these volume pedals that they got obsessed with, and they're excruciating.
On Help they are as well, the volume.
Yeah, pedal. They're on Help as well. But I think it's in... is it in The Word or something like that? And they're out of time. Right. And they just sound horrible.
I was thinking The Word is the Beatles' funkiest song.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The Word is brilliant.
That tambourine and nice, like...
It's
got to be up there.
Yeah, it's got to be up there. It's
got to be up there.
Jazz funk,
I'll give you top 10 without even looking into it.
Where else do they go into funk?
I believe they're the funkiest band that's ever lived.
Yeah, definitely are, yeah. Yeah.
They sold their soul for funk, I believe.
When people say funk, they think Beatles, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, I love funk. Like, Beatles shit.
Yeah, Beatles shit.
Oh, I'm on that Beatles shit.
One question that we ask everyone on the podcast is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I do, and it started... I texted Mae Martin this morning to let her know this was going to be my one, and it's not going to be popular in this room, I already know it. Okay. I think Obladi Oblada is great.
Oh,
no, it's not.
And I know you had a big problem with it. I think the arrangement on the White Album is terrible and doesn't do it any favours. Mm. I think the sequencing of the tracks. No, the arrangement of the song.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't like it until I heard it on...
You liked the version on Yesterday, the film. You didn't like the song. Heard Yesterday, the film, and then...
There was That's my favorite.
Neil Sheeran.
Backwards from that. I'm from the world of that film.
You're right. Yeah.
And then I crossed over. And I was surprised to be like, okay, I've got to get on board with these three.
Yeah.
You're the one. Yeah. Okay. If you listen to it on Anthology 3, it's a pretty straight performance, just strumming away at the guitar. It's not like, you know, it sounds far less cringe when he's not, when all of the chords aren't upstrokes on the offbeat.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's just strumming straight and he's doing less of a, it's not like he's kind of doing a bit of a voice. He is but he's not
millimeters
on Anthology 3
from full sort of Jim Davison.
But it's far less problematic on Anthology 3. It just sounds like a great. I mean, John shouts a mad bit at the start of it, and you can't get away from the. It still sounds weird him saying brah, but the rest of the song I think is great and it's super catchy and it's a far better version and I love it.
Yes!
I think it's good to hear it being defended. I mean,
I haven't convinced you even very slightly.
But I mean, the thing is, when I'm listening to White Album, I never skip it though.
Because it's your favourite.
Yeah, I like the way. Do you know that bit at the end where he gets the words wrong and he says Desmond stays at home and does his pretty face?
Yeah, he wanted to do another take of that. Mm. He was really angry about it. And he wanted to do another take.
Well, famously, it was the long. I think. Might be right in saying the longest time that they took to record any track.
I think Maxwell Silverhammer wasn't far off as well, but Lennon wasn't in the studio for Maxwell Silverhammer.
Yeah. I'll take Maxwell Silverhammer over Obladi Obladi any day.
Maxwell Silverhammer is my least favourite Beatles song.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
I think because I got into it when I was a kid, though, I just thought it was quite sort of funny and I liked the noise of the ding ding.
I can get you a recording that just does the ding ding if you like, and you can forget the rest of the song. I can make that for you.
It's about a man who goes around killing people with a hammer.
I think that's what I was quite intrigued because I think kids like that sort of like slightly macabre.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what he says? You know, he says pataphysical at the start.
What? That's the first thing he says.
Yeah.
What, Joan was quizzical.
Studied pataphysical. Is it pataphysical?
No, I think that's that thing where, you know, when you learn a new word, you got to quickly, you got to use it or you're going to lose it.
He's quickly
going to write a song.
It's probably why he laughs in the line, because he's so pleased with himself.
Yeah, pataphysics is a difficult to define. This is Wikipedia. Right. First sentence. Difficult to define philosophy of science invented by French writer Alfred Jarry.
Sounds like Wikipedia has been put on the spot.
Yeah.
And that sounds retroactively...
History works influenced by pataphysiology. Let's go down to that bit.
Okay.
It's got to say Maxwell Silverhammer. No, it was a select pieces from Marcel Duchamp and John Cage.
Right.
Situationism.
Okay. Oh, so he would have got it out of the sort of happenings at the Round House or whatever.
The Maxwell Silverhammer on the Beatles album Abbey Road, Pataphysical Science, is mentioned as a course of study for Maxwell Edison's first victim, Joan.
Yeah, using the word victim makes it sound a bit more grisly.
Yeah, more or less my route to the Beatles was going via heavy metal bands, and then when the Strokes came out, I suddenly was like, oh, I actually prefer this to any... I prefer this to Megadeth and Slayer and Anthrax and Pantera. And this, in some ways, sounds heavier to me.
Mm.
And then that made me feel like it was okay to like any kind of music, because the Strokes was considered soft amongst my group of friends. And so I was like, well, that's... From then on, I guess I'm allowed to listen to just whatever I like now.
Yeah. It's interesting that I was listening to Bleach the other day. Nirvana. And it's like, God, it's such a weird album. And Kurt Cobain is like absolutely rinsing his voice and doing these weird screams and howls. It's such a like odd album. And I was like listening to it when I was 12. And like, and the songs are so dark as well. And it's like, it's weird how you just take all that stuff in at that age, like getting into metal. Or
But
it's like...
I was really into... Around I used to really love Slint. You remember Slint?
Yeah.
Post rock, sludgy.
Obsessed with them for a while.
I saw them live. Because you know they were doing the whole reunion thing. It was just amazing. It was brilliant, and because many people like obsessed with Spiderland, it was like literally like almost ecstatic. People like sort of singing along to the riffs or something, or like cheering at
You can't really sing along to the words. No. Like, it's just a guy chatting at you.
Yeah.
Very calmly.
So fucking good. It was brilliant.
I used to look at that. I used to just listen to it and just look at that album cover of Spiderland.
Taken by Will Oldham, that photograph.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, Bonnie Prince Billy.
Oh, cool.
Because they're from that Louisville, Kentucky scene. They all kind of started together at the same same time. Yeah.
Was Kurt Cobain always a massive... He was more of a Lennon person than a Beatles person, or was he really into the Beatles?
He would love the Beatles.
I Want to Hold Your Hand was his favourite, so I guess it's like a Lennon guy. But he mainly talks about the early Beatles, weirdly.
Yeah, he grew up thinking that they were still around, and he was really sad when he realised that it was all over. I think he had the records and stuff, and he thought they were kind of still around.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
Next time he does a show, I'll try and talk to him afterwards.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, try and grab him.
Yeah, we should get him on the podcast.
But I think he's got... I mean, like, when he was doing Nevermind, like, Butch Vig, it was all about trying
the
to make
his tracking
voice as double... Yeah, like Lennon-esque as possible. But I think Cobain has got a very... I mean, it's amazing how he can just suddenly get these melodies from nowhere, you know, like Drain You or something, or you know, there are just some even songs on Bleach that just they suddenly go into these almost McCartney-esque melodies.
About a Girl's very sort of Beatles for Sale-y.
About a Girl's one of those songs where you think if it was recorded by any other artist, it would sound like an almost like wimpy pop song. It's kind of really soft.
But sort of appealed to so many people in the early, because I mean it is just basically pop music that is just given a sort of slightly rougher sandpaper and you know all of those melodies are just as well constructed as any of those like McCartney things.
She gives me everything, and tenderly
I think the same as of I don't know if you guys know Rancid.
Yeah.
They're the band who I find the feeling I get when I listen to early Beatles, the band that I most closely the band that I feel most similarly towards is Rancid.
Mm.
Still, it still feels like, because they're, you know, I mean, they're far less tight as a band and they cannot sing. But the vibe is that like that energy and the just a group of pals
like
together.
I mean, so much punk. Like, well, obviously, you know, there is a whole genre of pop punk. But like Rancid, like Ruby Soho, that is classic pop. Isn't
oh
it?
Yeah, that's it's so good. Like they wrote that third Pink album.
Yeah,
and when it came out, I was like, yeah, this makes perfect sense.
Is that the one with?
No, that's the album after. But yeah, the one with the one with Trouble on it.
Oh right,
which could, you know, could
good.
Be a Rancid song.
Yeah,
it's only the fact that he, you know, sounds like he's been gargling glass that makes it not a pop track.
It's quite strange that the Beatles' sort of flirtation with heavy metal and their part in pioneering it was so sort of fleeting, really.
Was Helter Skelter?
Well, Helter Skelter for sure, and like definitely, like, you know, stuff like She's So Heavy, that breakdown is you know, as heavy as it was possible to get.
Yeah.
But then they sort of abandoned it very quickly. I mean, there's nothing on McCartney that you could say is like remotely heavy metal-y.
Yeah.
But maybe that was a reaction against the sort of rise of the Led Zeppelins and Aerosmiths or whatever.
But I kind of think, I think similarly to how I feel about Peter Cook in comedy, in that he's sort of, certainly up until, I would argue, up until more or less The Office, basically everything that happened in comedy from Beyond the Fringe until 2001.
Yeah.
Peter Cook had done some version of sort of creates the satire boom.
Mm.
Then it's like, even like Derek and Clive is way ahead of its time, like way more. It's like, you know,
gross out humor or kind of
But more than like something like I'm trying to think of an example. More goes much further than The Young Ones or Bottom or something like that. And that's like, you know, 20 years earlier.
Similarly, there's a theory that Black Sabbath invented every kind of metal, isn't there?
Right.
There's like doom metal, there's like thrash,
I could easily be convinced by that. I could very quickly be convinced by that.
Were they Beatles people, Sabbath?
Yeah, I think Ozzy's a huge fan. And Lemmy was as well.
He was huge. I think he went to quite a lot of gigs, I think, didn't he? When he was a teenager.
The quote from Ozzy Osbourne was, all I wanted to be was Lennon or McCartney. I ended up being fucking Ozzy Osbourne.
Well, it worked out okay for him.
Yeah. It was so nice for Ozzy Osbourne to pop into the recording.
Yeah, of course.
What a very kind... He couldn't stay.
Yeah, where's he gone?
Doff of the cap and off he goes. Into the night.
Do you remember the first... when the Osbournes came out?
I felt like I was going insane.
Yeah, the first episode has still got one of my funniest things ever. When he's
is that
watching,
where he chucks the thing over the fence?
Yeah, and he's watching Two Fat Ladies. And he says... But there's a bit where he goes, how do you get these two fat cunts off my seat? That's so good.
Was Peter Cook as like your current sort of life as a writer and comedian? Was he more of a formative influence than like Python or anything in that for you?
No, I would never really sit down for any period of time to listen to him. Although I enjoyed the 12 Days of Christmas, Sir Arthur Street Griebling stuff, and the Why Bother series with Chris Morris, which again is like he should be. By rights, Peter Cook should be about 30 years irrelevant by that point, and he's very comfortable riffing with this guy who's at the absolute forefront of comedy in the mid-90s at that point.
Yeah.
And you just... he's great, but I wouldn't, like, sit and...
Who was your big comedy heroes when you were growing up? What, like, made you want to do comedy?
Growing up, it was just... I guess Ali G, probably.
Right.
When I was a little kid, the Chuckle Brothers.
Right.
Mm.
And which I stand by. And the first few times I pitched a show, first few times I pitched with Sheeps, my comedy group, we would try and explain over and over again that what we wanted to make was the Chuckle Brothers.
Right.
And people would be like, oh, yeah, like, I get it, like a gritty, like adult version of that. And we'd be like, no, we want to make the Chuckle Brothers. And they're going, oh, right, so like a dark version. They're going, no, I want to make a, it's like just these silly guys and they can't get anything right.
Yeah.
That ultimately is why I got into comedy.
Right.
And then as I got older, Tim and Eric was the main influence on everything.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Nice.
On Sheeps.
Yeah, I would say at least for my part, Tim and Eric and Stella, the US series Stella, which is obviously different from the UK one, which was.
I've not seen that. What's the gist
Michael Ian Black, Michael Showalter, and David Wayne. Yeah, they're just these three guys going around being very, very silly. There's no consistency. All the three characters are identical to each other. They often speak in unison, even. They have no arc across an episode that you can realistically spot.
Yeah.
And none of their decisions you could really trace to any kind of logic. It's aggressively silly.
Yeah.
And it was cancelled after 8 episodes.
Wow, that
and
sounds
it's,
great.
To be honest, they were lucky to get them all broadcast, really.
Yeah.
It's just nonsense. But it is the thing that it still makes me laugh more than anything else.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what is the kind of writing process for Sheeps?
We just come up with stuff separately and have a chat. It's very casual. It's a very casual vibe.
Yeah. Well, it's like brilliantly anarchic and yet obviously very well rehearsed and thought out and stuff. It's probably the most...
I would agree on thought out. I would disagree on rehearsed.
Well, maybe when you've seen the end of an Edinburgh run or something.
Yeah, sure. Sort of, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It was responsible for the only time I thought I was in medical trouble. The Fringe a couple of years ago Harry Potter sex
Live and Loud Selfie Sex Harry Potter. Which the Live and Loud is from Nirvana.
Nice.
MTV Live and Loud show is I just thought of that as a stupid stupid thing to say. Of course it's live, it's a show.
So we were talking to Mae Martin the other day about which Friends characters would be which Beatle.
Oh, yeah.
If you had to attribute a Beatle to the Sheeps trio, which ones would you choose?
I would... Three Ringos. We're playing Three Ringos.
That's actually
Ringos.
A really good name for a band.
Yeah. Three Ringos, yeah. Actually, Al, who's in Sheeps, wanted his pitch for what he wanted to call Sheeps was the Beatles of comedy. which I still wish we'd gone with. I love that.
It seemed
like we couldn't have done it at the time, and now I think we should have called it the Beatles of comedy.
That's brilliant.
He's a big Beatles fan as well.
Really?
You should get him in.
Oh,
that'd
be brilliant.
It's like half of what we talk about.
Really?
And Liam doesn't really really know anything about him. So
He's so funny and stuff. Let's flat.
Yeah, right? He's great.
It's amazing. Well, the bit that just always makes me laugh is, you know, when he goes to the clothes shop.
Yeah.
With Tasha Dimitri and he ends up with a T-shirt that says Urban Christ.
I think he's one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Right.
He really is.
So I assume Liam gets a little bit fed up with your constant Beatles chat then, if he's the third wheel in the Beatles
But then me and Liam talk about Only Fools and Horses almost all of the time.
Really?
And Al doesn't. I don't think Al's even seen the show.
Really?
Yeah, that's we're just obsessed with it. I don't think either of us like it.
Mm. Yeah.
But we talk about it a lot.
Do you? Is that because you know it really? Super
yeah,
well?
It's right. Just like just every episode from being a kid.
Yeah.
Just completely. I mean, this is probably my controversial opinion, but you know, as a kid, I'm sure you guys were similar as comedy nerds growing up. Anything with a laugh track, I would watch.
Yeah.
Didn't matter how good it was. But the only thing I never liked was Only Fools and Horses.
Right. Oh, really?
I'd watch The British Empire and The Real McCoy.
Only Fools and Horses could be very, very funny.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that went on far too long.
Though. Yeah. And I also, the version I remember is the later years.
Oh, it could be very, very
with funny. There was good
and
stuff.
Ending or whatever.
Those last ones, I cannot be doing with them last ones.
I've got a very vivid memory of my parents were out and they'd set the video to record Only Fools and Horses. And I'd sort of fannied around with the video player or the VHS.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was on, and I could see it wasn't recording, but I didn't know how to sort of get it recording. Mm. So I just kind of had to blank out the fact that I knew it wasn't working in my mind, you know?
I think
I had to, like, hold my hand up in front of the VHS and watch it above my hand so that I would manage to deal with this terrible guilt that I knew I'd messed up my parents' recording.
Sure.
So it's just come back to me.
The thing I like most about Ringo is when the first album he did after the Beatles broke up, all three of the others contributed songs to his album. It seems like even when Harrison started sleeping with Ringo's wife.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like any of them ever fell out with Ringo.
No.
It feels like they were always good with Ringo.
Yeah.
And this makes me really like him a lot. And there's a really sweet thing at the when Ringo was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame solo, which is only a few years ago. Mm. And two things that I really loved about it was Yoko came to the performance, because clearly she must have just been so fond of Ringo. Mm. And there's a lovely moment when Paul inducts him and they're doing little jokes together, like Paul's trying to rush him along in his speech, and like Ringo snaps back with something Liverpudlian. And he cuts to the crowd and Yoko Ono's just laughing to herself.
Oh,
she's
so
really
nice.
Enjoying it as though she's saying, like, it's just her watching two of John's mates having a giggle. And it's really, it's really, really, really sweet.
So
and it
sweet.
Does just go, oh, yeah. I mean, I think, it's her role in them breaking up is, I think, so...
exaggerated.
It's so exaggerated, It's like whenever people describe how the Beatles ended, when they're like, oh, they were spending less and less time with one another and more time with their partners. It's like, well, this is just a description of anybody coming towards the end of their 20s. What are you talking about? That's the description of all of my friendships.
Yeah.
There's so much snobbery around it as well, isn't there? Of kind of like, oh, John's getting too arty. He's like going out with the situationist. Ooh.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this slight
kind of...
He seems
really happy.
Yeah.
Like he's fallen in love.
Yeah. Yeah.
This idiot.
Thinking about John's sort of joy that he used to get from sort of being mischievous in a way, and it's the sort of, I think, the Paul and John thing we talk about so much, but it's the difference between cheekiness and mischievousness. And because there's something...
How are you defining that difference?
Well, I think because Paul could be flippant and he could be sort of, you know, a bit hard work and... and undercut everyone in interviews, but it was also always done with such a kind of playful, boyish charm. Whereas John's was always a bit more sort of acerbic and.
But I think Paul
nasty.
Was maybe more secure. I think John, there's genuine like hate underneath it, which he acknowledges in later life.
But I think that's also an incredibly powerful thing, and then counterbalanced with someone like Paul, who's like ridiculously optimistic, and just everything is about the joy and the beauty. That, you know, that's the yin and the yang of why it works so well, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, but I often think that Paul who is the one I identify with most and the one I admire the most, and just I absolutely love him. He's the I just think there's no way Paul could possibly have made it by himself.
No,
and I say that believing that he's the best of them.
Yeah,
not even as a musician. I think he's like, you know, obviously he's the best singer and bassist, or arguably best singer, but he's maybe the best guitarist and maybe the best drummer in the band as well. Yeah. He's like and the only real pianist in the band. But I just don't think he's not got that thing that Lennon has that would make people go, ooh, what's this then? Mm. They would just go, oh, it's another talented guy.
Mm. Yeah.
Who cares?
Mm. And I think he was well aware of that as well, which is why he was so desperate to keep the band going. It was kind of for his artistic self-preservation, as well as his sort of want for, you know, the legacy or whatever. And then he was constantly, I mean, Ian McDonald, we can't go through a podcast without mentioning Ian McDonald, I don't think, but he talks about it really well, and that his desperate need to connect with someone who had a more, you know, edgy artistic sensibility that he never was able to recapture.
There is like a real insecurity to McCartney, isn't there? I was thinking about, because, you know, Let It Be Naked as a project was Paul McCartney going back to a record he'd made 30 years ago and like literally cutting and pasting words that had been pronounced wrong and stuff like that. So, you know, which is great. And I think the Let It Be Naked project is really good. But like Paul McCartney has got a real like, there's an insecurity there about that must have haunted him for 30 years.
I think he was trying to win an argument. Yeah, I think because the whole Get Back project is his idea.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, we've got to... And it doesn't become what he wants. He doesn't like Phil Spector. He doesn't like Alan Klein at that time. Yeah. He's like pretending to be the first one to leave the band, even though John's already said it like 6 months earlier that he's leaving. Yeah. And but he didn't have any control over how the album ended. And I think... because that period of time is characterized so much by his absolute pathological need to be completely in control. It's like, well, it's so annoying that that one slipped out of his...
Yeah, that's true.
But that must have really hurt. I mean, he talks in that role, the GQ interview recently where he brings all that stuff up, and it obviously still really
rankles,
haunts him, because, you know, he is vindicated, especially in terms of like the Alan Klein stuff, and you know, and Phil Spector turned out to be not a very good egg. And you know, John was being incredibly self-destructive and sabotaging those sessions and things. So, you know, you would think that the vindication would be enough, but to go back and, you know, patch it all up. And also they weren't working with much like on those records. Like we've said lots of times that I'm a big fan of Let It Be, but when you listen to Let It Be Naked, you realise that the bare bones of those sessions is pretty poor. Like George's, you know, stuff like George's slide playing, which is usually, you know, I think for me, behind Ry Cooder, is the best slide guitarist ever to record slide on record, and the difference between what he's playing on that record and what he puts down on Living in the Material World, which is only a couple of years later, is unbelievable. So you can tell his heart's not really in it, and you can sort of, you can sense the frustration of it massively. And I think,
I mean, the Harrison songs on Let It, like the what's the 12 bar blues one?
I mean,
because
mine.
You're sweet and lovely, it's true.
Oh no, I mean mine's on.
Yeah, I mean mine's in there.
All Things Must Pass was passed over for that record, but like, which it's I would argue, except for maybe, I really like Two of Us, I really like Across the Universe, I really like Let It Be, the actual song. But other than that, I mean, I think All Things Must Pass is better than anything else on that record, but Paul wouldn't let it on. And the explanation given was that it just wasn't good enough.
Yeah, that's...
like, well, that's okay, you're putting...
Yeah. But then also, like, McCartney as well, by doing Naked, he... you know, he took off the Maggie May and he took off Dig It, the like... The
and all
song.
Of the little sort of goony interludes. Yeah. It doesn't even start with the sort of, I dig a pygmy.
Yeah. And I get the impression as well, because he took off the bit before Let It Be where Lennon says something like, you know...
And now we're going to sing out the angels.
Yeah.
Well, that's because he used to take the piss out of the song so much for being... He was like, it's something you sing at Catholic school or whatever.
Yeah. But you can just imagine, like, the decision to take that off 30 years later...
Yeah,
well, I think like because they were put in such a... Paul had no control over the sequencing of the record.
Yeah.
Sure.
And all of that stuff was put in just to be a bit twatty by Lennon. So, you know, I could, because that's the version I grew up with. I quite like the sort of little Peter Sellers-y interludes, all of that stuff. It looks, it feels like they're having fun to my ears, but then when you read about it and you realise he's actually bullying.
I often think that re-including Don't Let Me Down on Naked, I think is almost a concession to be like, I think it's his like peace offering to the Lennon fan base because of him taking so much more control back. He's like, well, I'll give them a whole song that wasn't on the original as an apology.
I love that song though.
But it's so weird. It's like, do you know William Wordsworth, he wrote The Prelude and he wrote different editions of it, and one's like 1812. And one's like 1814. Then he did another one like 1856 or something. So just let it go. Let it be. But how can you... It's weird. Like, is it the same thing if you come back to it after that same length, after that length of time? Just because...
But I guess his argument would be that it wasn't anyway because it was all done after the fact by Spectre. Right, like, because it was meant that that Get Back album just didn't happen. But it's like, maybe it's just... If you two do it every... Almost every album that U2 releases, or every two or three albums, they release one. And then when the singles come out for the album, they release, there's like 50 remixes of the single. And they start saying in interviews, they always say, we did the album wrong. I'm so sorry, we did the album wrong. They did it with like, they did it with Achtung Baby, they did it with Pop, which is a great album. They did it, a lot of it with Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. They're really... obsessive about redoing
stuff.
That's
really what's interesting about, say, Life of Pablo, the Kanye West album. He was literally changing, you know, because it's on streaming, you could literally take this version
up until that morning.
You know, so like he completely changed what an album even means there. Because now, you know.
It's interesting. I mean, the same with those remixes. It's like, I don't think I'm ever going to go back to listen to. I've got two versions of Sgt. Pepper over there, and one is the one that my mum bought in 1967. And the other one's the remix of that. I'm never going to listen to that original mix of it because it's not as good. Like, it doesn't sound as good. But then, you are changing the artifact. Like, you know, it's the same as, you know, no, you can't get the original Star Wars cuts because George Lucas has tried all he can. And I think that's a big thing with the Paul stuff because he fought so hard to get control back. Over the stuff after the whole Alan Klein debacle and then Michael Jackson stealing it all. So once he got it back, he was like, okay, now we've got to do, you know, all of the, fix all of these little mistakes and stuff.
Yeah, sure.
But as long as those two versions of the record exist, then take your pick.
He's constantly revising even facts about the, I mean, he's, the one of the reasons why those not unreasonable period of time in which I was, or I should say not inconsiderable, there was a not inconsiderable amount of time in which I was convinced by the Paul is dead theories.
Right.
Because whenever you hear him in an interview, he's got a different explanation as to how he came up with a song every time you hear him. And it's always, usually, he's just trying to creep in a bit more credit for the song now that, and I don't think it's out of spite. I think it is like just, kind of double think of he's convinced himself now.
The Lennon McCartney McCartney Lennon thing, which was a bit ill advised.
I mean, it's just opening up. Like, I you give him an inch on that. Okay, I can understand you'll want Yesterday to say McCartney Lennon or Blackbird to be McCartney Lennon, but then he's suddenly allowed to start saying it about other things. I mean, in interviews he claims so much. I mean, I'd say this. Absolutely loving him, but I do sometimes think if you listen to interviews, there's that there's a few clips online of Lennon going through the White Album and saying who wrote what, and he quite often he'll say that one's all Paul, and sometimes it's with songs he doesn't want anything to,
I've listened to an interview where they ask him about that and he's like, so is this one of your songs, Obadiah Obadiah, and he's like,
that's all
you know, it's mostly me. John Lennon be like, that had nothing to do with it.
He'll be like,
he tried to take a lot of claim for one of those, like a really good Paul song he had, like Eleanor Rigby, he tried to claim he wrote like most of that, I think.
Lennon did. But now Lennon can't snap back. So now you have Paul saying, like, John came in and He said, "I've got this song. It's called I wanna hold your legs, you know." And he said, "I've got a melody. It goes like this: I want to hold your legs." I said, "That's pretty good, but make it hands, John. I've got a melody here for you as well." And he's like, "And then so it's pretty much." And then he'll always end by something that tries to make it seem that he's not doing what he was doing, and say, yeah. "So it's pretty much 50-50." Yeah, well,
if you go through the LP from top to bottom, it's Paul's first contribution, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which is a. I don't know. It's fairly typical of a lot of songs Paul's written, John, do you think?
Yeah, it's a typical McCartney sing-along or whatever you call them. He did quite a lot of work on it. I was ill after the accident when they did most of that track.
To come back to Only Fools and Horses again, there's a clip of David Jason that I really enjoy. When David Jason basically seems to do the same thing with John Sullivan since right. John Sullivan passed. There's a clip that haunts me on one of these, like, 50... haunts me as a... You know, if my job is primarily as a writer, so being properly credited for things constant... Yeah. Like, a constant... I'll use the word trauma for me. But yeah, there's a bit where he's going... it's on, like, the 50 greatest moments in all of the history of comedy in the history of the world. And there's Falling Through a Bar because that's the best thing. And
he says he came up with
Falling. Yeah, he says
70% of that fall. John Sullivan said I should only fall about 30%.
That genuinely no, but that is. I don't know if you're doing a bit or remembering it. That is almost exactly what he says. He goes, there's a bit where he says, like, and then John says, "You should." She's going to open the bar, and he wants you to very slightly stumble, and then look at Trigger and go into. Kiss these girls. Yeah. And he goes, "No, John, no, I've got to fall all the way through." And he said, "No, Jason, that's why would he ever make such a mistake?" It's absolutely mad. So mad. And he said, "We should do with the chandelier." He said, "You boys should do a fantastic job and be paid for it." And I said, "John, we should drop the wrong chandelier."
The episode ends with them just doing chandelier. Yeah. There we go. That's it.
It should be cleaned. You should be paid a day's wage for a day's work. Yeah. And then we'll get the credits. I said, "John, I've thought of a funny thing we could do with that chandelier instead." Because David, it'll never work. No, it will, John. It will. Please. Please trust me.
Yeah, like just coming up with a spur of the moment. If you drop the chandelier, while you're filming it.
Yeah, well, maybe on set. Yeah, could we try dropping that one, John?
Yeah, do a couple of takes of that.
I think there is a lot of that in McCartney now that he is completely in control of the narrative. Mm. And I understand. I kind of understand why. In that, I do think the lion's share of the Beatles is. Him certainly from Rubber Soul onwards, but because John is so much more charismatic, inevitably people think of John as the genius, which I don't think is fair. But as a result, I think in his head he's maybe justified. Well, I want everyone to know every bit of my contribution. Everybody does it in like you easily can convince yourself you wrote more than you actually wrote. There's been occasions where. Like, I've had TV shows go out and me and another writer have been both equally convinced we wrote a gag, you know. Mm. And these are shows that are far more famous than anything the Beatles did. You know? These are big hits. Yeah. That's why I got so many series of them. And then they're never cancelled after the second series, almost every time. You can easily convince yourself of that. And particularly as somebody who's, job is almost entirely on the behind the scenes writing. You do sometimes. I'll notice myself sometimes claiming credit for slightly more than I actually am out purely because I'll feel like, well, the person who's in it gets loads of credit anyway. Mm. They're gonna get some of my credit, so I'll try and steal some. But now, if for Paul, when everyone finds John so charismatic, I can understand why he would go for it. But I think he's got so carried away. He now believes, because you know.
But I think probably to be a little bit less cynical, or to give him the benefit of the doubt, like there's no bigger Beatles fan in the world than Paul McCartney.
Sure, yeah.
And he just is obsessed with the legacy. He loves spinning anecdotes. You just get the sense that he would happily just talk about the Beatles all day, every day. And so to that, I mean, it just tends to be everything he thinks about. So
also, if you tell the same story every night, it's like you'll see it with like stand-ups. You know, I guess I'm sure you'll have done this a lot. You'll sometimes just change a bit just because you're bored of saying it the other way, not because you think it's better in a new way. Like, and if he's telling this, he's asked to tell the same anecdote so many times, like any good storyteller, he's a liar. Like, a bit, you kind of, I guess you have to be.
Otherwise, you're George Martin in the big train sketch where Kevin Eldon gets wielded away when he's telling the same.
God, I'd forgotten about that. I haven't seen that in so long.
He starts, and George came in, and I said, well, is there anything you don't like? And he says, well, I don't like your tie, for a start. And then these people just carry him away and put him in a van, and he's still telling the story and telling the story.
Yeah. The first feedback tone was...
And then someone asked him about it, and he was like, so why do you think you keep asking me... telling the same stories. It's like, well, they keep asking me the same questions. Yeah. Just like, well, can't say fairer than that.
Yeah, sure.
So apparently Paul's a big Beatles fan.
That's seamless. Yeah, no, this was just regarding... I think it's a question that... very few people, maybe none in the history of the world, could possibly answer is, what on earth does Paul McCartney want from a day?
I think he just loves being Paul McCartney, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But no matter what, because even when he puts out a really good album, like Flaming Pie, I think is great. Yeah. Band on the Run, I think is great. Chaos of Creation, I really like.
Yeah, that's great.
I know you mentioned it on the on May's episode, but that's... I really like that album. I quite like the most recent one with that. I do not like the song "Fuck You," but the one that's it's like Ryan Tedder, I think, produced a lot of it, which he also did with "Songs of Innocence" by U2, and on both of them, I like the album, but they sound kind of like a Ryan Tedder album. I think even when he puts out a good album, like what's when he listens back to it, it would be so tough to not go, sorry. I mean, it's not Revolver. It's not Revolver good, but that's really, even when like Flaming Pie, which I think is so good, listening to it back, he can't have felt anything more than great. That is. Almost as good as the worst Beatles one.
What do you reckon is the best McCartney song?
Jet. I'm not even joking.
Really?
Jet kicks the shit out of me. Jet fucking slams. I can listen to Jet 20 times in a row and I'll still feel...
The first time I heard it was Alan Partridge jumping on a bed and bouncing up.
When he plays it live, people go...
Really?
I would go apeshit if I
always remember the funny.
It's got the classic cringy. I think love and maybe I'm amazed and those big ballady ones.
Oh, that's so nice. That's the first time I heard that was in DOC.
Another Day is
his vocal on Maybe I'm Amazed is a contender for the best rock and roll vocal on any record.
That voice is stupid good.
Unbelievable. His voice got much better after the Beatles as well. Because I'm a singer, so
he really shreds with his natural, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a natural tenor, you don't really hit your peak until your mid 30s anyway. And because his range is like absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
Right. And he smoked loads of fags and pot.
Yeah.
Like his voice in the Wings Over America version of Maybe I'm Amazed. And his piano playing as well is absolutely fantastic. It's just extraordinary.
What is the best?
Beats Freddie Mercury for anything live.
Shut up, really?
Freddie Mercury used to cheat live all the time.
Well, what do you mean?
He would always bottle high notes. He was an amazing performer, but as a singer...
He would go down the octave or he'd hit the fifth or something.
Yeah. Whereas Paul...
keep on fighting.
Yeah, exactly. He's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, obviously... Freddie Mercury is an incredible singer, but he's a studio singer more than he's a live singer. But yeah, Paul's live stuff is just nuts.
Right, you think Paul is a better singer than Freddie Mercury?
I think live he can do it better,
I think Paul's not far off the best singer. Going back to Jet suffers from what I would call the main solo Paul problem. Which is that he's so interested in the music, he just doesn't finish the lyrics. So he has, like, all of his albums have at least two or three songs that are plagued by the second, like, just keep repeating verses over and over again. Songs like, I think the early indication that this is where things are going is with Hello Goodbye, where it's just, it's so repetitive, and it's quite a long song to have almost no new lyrics. There's maybe five lines in the whole song.
I mean, it's also something that a toddler would write.
Sure, yeah. But if you were to... Hello Goodbye could easily have been one of the best Beatles songs if he'd finished writing lyrics for it. If it told any kind of a story at all. Yeah. I do often think...
Brilliant melody.
It's so good. Yeah. But I can't listen to it because every time I listen to it, it's the equivalent of listening to that song five or six times.
Yeah.
Because I've heard him say it so many times. Yeah, just about gets away with it because it's so fucking sick.
Yeah. I always think that about Your Mother Should Know would be one of the great Beatles songs if it didn't just repeat the first verse four times.
I hate
Your Mother Should Know.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. Oh, I'm with you. That's quintessential McCartney instinctive melody.
Right.
When you can draw a line up and down of how that, you know...
It's very good.
It's music 101, like...
But it's sort of where he's slightly going into When I'm 64 sort of territory, and he's a bit like, I don't know.
Paul's granny music.
Yeah.
It was referred to it.
But he wrote that, you know, that's another one that has its origins in the Hamburg days, I think.
I'm 64, it's really...
That was written on the piano, his dad's piano, little house.
I wish I didn't know that because of the James Corden.
Yeah.
I was reading that Craig Brown book, and it's amazing. And it's amazing and frustrating how often his references
James Corden's
show. It's like, because no matter how much he's clearly been researching this book for years and years and years and years and put an enormous amount of work into it, but you can't compete with the fact that Corden went to the actual house with him.
Yeah, and apparently he coaxed him into, they drove past it, and apparently he was just like, have you ever been in? And he was like, no. He's like, let's go in. And just like literally barged in there and ended up getting this like priceless bit of YouTube gold that will be clipped out for generations. Couldn't happen to a nicer bloke.
But I mean, that says something for McCartney that whatever your feelings about James Corden, that YouTube video is still really amazing.
I loved it. Despite myself, I had the time of my life.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
I watched it a few times.
Yeah, it's great.
Nobody could ever do anything 10% as significant in popular music as what they did, or I mean as much to as many people. It's just impossible now. And seeing any of them do anything, it really is like... it really is God's walking among us. It's as close as there is to such a thing. It's insane.
So that was Jono. That was brilliant. We had such a fun time recording that, and it was really fun listening to it back in the edit and remind us of a very pleasant evening. I was hoping that like this would be the first of many IRL records, but it's looking like that. It's possibly getting less and less likely, but it was great fun and good pub session afterwards.
Yeah, the conversation continued.
So thank you so much to Jono for coming on. And if you enjoyed that, we're also going to be speaking to another member of Sheeps in a couple of weeks, Al Roberts, who you might also know from Stathless Flats, and also, as Jono describes him there, one of the funniest people on the planet. Yeah. So that is pretty exciting. And we'll be back next week with Hazel Wild from the band Lanterns on the Lake, who are up for the Mercury Music Prize this week, which is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of... So we're recording this before the awards ceremony, so it's kind of a Schrodinger's Mercury at the moment, isn't it? Don't know if he will win or not, but I'm really looking forward to that chat because it's a brilliant album, and I've known the band for a while, just clanging that one in, but it's really great to see them being rewarded because they work jolly hard. It should be a really interesting chat, I think.
Yeah, so please join us next Tuesday where we'll be talking to Hazel Wild, and keep in touch and keep your emails coming in. We always love to read them. We do read everything, even if we don't have time to read it out. So thank you very much for listening. Please give us a nice 5-star rating if you enjoyed the show, and see you next week.
Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie.
It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Very good.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.